CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft to comment on the run-up to the meeting between the two presidents, President Putin and President Biden, in Switzerland in these next days. The preparation is in all areas because the two countries are sentimentally at odds over the last 100 years or more, having to do with the politics of the 20th century. But here we are in the 21st century, and there are substantive issues between the two states and over several administrations now. The Bush administration, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, now the Biden administration, and the one that comes right away as an imponderable, but we must, is Ukraine. Anatole has very carefully arranged the history of how we got into the present frozen conflict, and we will begin with the beginning of that has to do with the breakup of the Soviet Union. And what I learned from Anatole were polling that was done before and after the breakup, and then an apparent misunderstanding by the people of Ukraine as to what the word independence, what the word united, what the word federalism might mean for their future. Anatole, a very good day to you. You are in the Middle East, and you look to the north. And in the north is the puzzlement about the Ukraine and Russia tangle over centuries. And you make it very clear that this matter also involves Crimea, but we're going to address Ukraine right now and not the separate and profound issue of Crimea. Over those centuries, Ukraine and Russia have enjoyed what you'd have to say easy traffic between the two states. And that left, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, a quandary for the people of Ukraine as to which way to go, to the word independence or to the word another way of staying united with Russia. You traveled there after the original, and you spoke with Ukrainians, I believe, 2 years after the breakup of the Soviet Union. What did you learn about Ukrainian intention for the future? And this is now nearly 30 years ago. Good day to you.
Hello, John. Yes, 30 years, my God. I was a journalist then, correspondent for the London Times, and Ukraine was part of my beat, as well as Russia and the other former Soviet republics. I actually went on a kind of honeymoon with my wife to Ukraine while researching a book about it. And what I found was that Ukrainians were deeply divided. Firstly, about whether to stay in the Soviet Union at all, a majority, 70%, actually voted to stay in the Soviet Union, though with increased power and autonomy for Ukraine, in the spring of 1991. By the autumn, after the coup in Moscow, as the Soviet Union disintegrated, you had a majority for independence. But Ukrainians were deeply divided about what independence meant. In the west of the country, which had formerly been part of Poland until Stalin seized it in 1939, for them independence meant independence. It means, you know, as independence is understood in the West, it meant complete independence from Russia, an international frontier with Russia, and Ukraine's right to break with Russia completely and join whatever international institutions it wanted. In the east of the country, people were not against Ukrainian independence, but I heard several times phrases like, oh, but of course, we want independence within the Soviet Union, we want Ukraine to be independent, but, you know, we want Ukraine still to remain very closely linked to Russia, often because these people were Russians ethnically or partly Russian, or were Ukrainian-speaking Russian. To be honest, across large parts of Ukraine, these are distinctions without a difference, because you can't really tell who's who in ethnic terms. And this split was reflected in every subsequent election up to 2014, where it's a little bit like the Republicans and the Democrats in America. You had you know, roughly 45% or more of the population committed to full Ukrainian independence and joining the West, joining NATO and the European Union. You had a similar number committed to remaining in alliance with Russia, and you then had a number in the middle who swung, you know, from one party or bloc to another, depending on circumstances. Now, in 2014, of course, the West won decisively. But a great many people in the east of Ukraine were deeply unhappy with this and launched basically a protest movement, which turned into a separatist revolt backed by Russia in the Donbass mining region. Now, how far a majority of the population actually supports independence from Ukraine is not at all clear, because, of course, no opinion poll since then has been reliable. But throughout the period after Ukrainian independence, you had repeated large majorities in that region for autonomy within Ukraine. In other words, for regional autonomy, which would guarantee Russian language rights, local self-rule, and so on. And that demand has basically been accepted by the international community. It was drawn up as part of the so-called Minsk Agreement or protocol in 2014-15 as a solution for the conflict in the Donbass. And the paper that you kindly mentioned for the Quincy Institute, which is coming out next week, argues that we, if there is any going to be any chance of solving this conflict in the Donbass, which has killed now 15,000 people or more, and it's even been talked about as a potential cause of war between America and Russia. If there's any chance of solving this, it can only be by going back to the Minsk Agreement and allowing autonomy for eastern Ukraine, but within Ukraine, under Ukrainian sovereignty. So that's basically what the paper is about.
Yes, the paper, though, is interweaving history with expectation, with what's in it for, questions about what's in it for Russia, what's in it for the United States, what's in it for the Minsk Minsk protocols that were a part of a conversation, I believe, between more than Russia and Ukraine. Germany was involved, France was involved, Britain was involved, and now the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. are involved as well. So I want to go to your two ambitions for a settlement that would be stable. One would be autonomy for Donbass, which is the eastern portion of Ukraine, excepting Crimea. And two, a demilitarization of the region. Both those, at this point, require a lot of trade-offs, a lot of compromise. So I want to start first with the Donbass autonomy. Again, that's a magical word, Anatole, as you know, and it means things to different people. If I understand correctly, the separatists, the Donbass separatists, are not of one mind all the time. In fact, they've divided into two different groups over these last, well, it's 7 years now. The Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic. What does autonomy mean to them? Before we explore the Minsk agreement again, I ask, what does it mean to the people who live in the Donbass to be autonomous?
Well, a lot of the separatist leadership would like to become fully independent, because then they would rule their own, you know, corrupt statelet. A lot of others, of course, want full union with Russia, like Crimea. In the end, though, they will have to do what Russia says. They're completely dependent on Russia economically and for military protection. And in 2014-15, the separatist authorities, which of course are not recognized by Ukraine or internationally, did agree with Moscow's backing and Moscow's urging to this solution based on autonomy. But the problem, as so often in these conflicts, is that they do not trust the Ukrainian state to maintain that autonomy, and therefore they want international guarantees of their autonomy, and they want either the exclusion of the Ukrainian army and its replacement with an international peacekeeping force, or they want to retain armed militias of their own.
Right.
Ukraine also committed itself in principle to autonomy and the Minsk solution. But it has basically been demanding ever since that the Donbass be completely handed back to Ukraine, and only then will Ukraine grant autonomy. And it's repeatedly refused to make a guarantee of permanent autonomy. So not surprisingly, both Moscow and the authorities in the Donbass say that they can't accept this because, you know, this would simply give it back to Ukraine with no long-term guarantees at all. So the sticking point has been the question of A, permanent autonomy, B, international guarantees, and C, what is the sequence in which all this happens. But in my view, as you know, with other such conflicts, the only answer must be an international presence, you know, an actual United Nations force on the ground. Well, you know, as in Bosnia and other cases, because without that, it's very difficult to see how a solution can be made to work.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. In preparation for the conversation between the presidents of Russia, the Russian Federation, and the United States of America, and Ukraine, as Anatole will explicate as we continue, would be the beginning of solutions of many difficult challenges between the two states, leading to sanctions and harsh words and misunderstanding. At the beginning of the Biden administration, this would be welcome for all. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.